It's time for Fed Talk, the live show for Feds in the know. From federal agencies to Capitol Hill, the attorneys of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth bring in experts from across the federal community to bring you inside the issues. Fed Talk is meant to provide general information about legal issues. However, the views expressed in this program are not intended to provide legal counseling. Listeners are cautioned not to rely upon any statements made in resolving legal issues they may face, but instead to consult with their own attorney about specific situations. Attorneys are not engaged in providing legal services while appearing on the program and are not responsible in any manner for the consequences that may stem directly or indirectly from reliance on any statement made during this program.
Good morning and welcome to Fed Talk. I'm Jenny Mattingly, and today I am joined by a couple folks from the federal community, experts, if you will, on information technology and technology generally here. I've got one federal CIO with me and two CTOs, and we are going to talk about how government agencies are handling technology and IT management these days. So we're joined in the studio today by Nagesh Rao with Small Business Administration, David Bray with Federal Communications Commission, and Brian Sivak with the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Welcome. And thanks for being here. And I've also got Jason Reifel with me today, who's going to help me out on the hosting side. And just a quick reminder that Fed Talk is brought to you by Geico, where 15 minutes could save you 15% on car insurance. For more information on Geico, go to geico.com. Well, thanks for being here. We're talking about some really fun stuff, fast changing and cutting edge, really, especially for the government these days, so of technology. And for our listeners, it'd be great if you guys could each tell me one or two things about yourself here. And Brian, why don't we start with you?
Sure. First of all, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure, as always, to be here. Couple things about myself. How about, I guess over the last 5 years, something that not a lot of people know is that I've hit the what I like to think of as the trifecta of government service. I started off by working for the city in Washington, D.C., and then the state for Governor O'Malley in Maryland, and now the Fed with HHS. Something else, I guess I would say that if I wasn't in D.C. working, you would probably find me somewhere on a wave surfing, hopefully.
Not a bad place to be, especially as it's getting cold outside.
That's right.
It sounds pretty nice right about now. So great. Well, thanks for being here. David, welcome.
Yes. Thanks for having me, Jenny. It's great to be with you all today. Apologize that apparently I'm overcoming a cold, but hopefully I'm still
I'm right there with you, so they may get the... We've got the tea going here. There's
yes.
a bunch of us.
Tea day in the studio.
Mm-hmm.
So in terms of things that people might not know about me, I'm a preacher's kid. My father is a Methodist minister. And I realize that the older I get, the way I approach technology and interacting with people on technology, it's very similar to him. We've compared notes, and in similar circumstances, it's about what's that narrative that brings together people and gets them to move forward in the same direction going forward. And so it's kind of interesting to find that I'm sort of a minister doing IT in the public service. The second thing that people might not know about me is I'm a big fan of poetry, and actually have on my office door the poem If by Rudyard Kipling. I always like to read the line which says, if you can keep your head about you when all are losing theirs and blaming it on you, I think that's very apt for the world we're in.
Absolutely. So, and that's a good deep thought to kick us off with. So Nagesh, welcome.
Thank you, Jenny. And it's great to be in this room of illustrious minds with David Bray and Brian Sivak. So thank you very much. I guess some things about me. Well, I split my time between here in San Francisco and New York as a chief technologist. And I've worked with some pretty cool startups and helped enable some private public-private partnerships. And they seem to be growing and doing well. So it's kind of nice to see some of the work I helped push forth a few years ago continue on. I like to learn how to play the guitar. So I've been working on that for the past few years. I've been engaged on that. And like Brian, I do enjoy some tasty waves, but I'm probably not as good as you. But when I go out to the West Coast, I'll try to at least hang out on the beach with my friends who are kite surfers. Mm. One day I will take it up. And I like to design tattoos. So I have I work on
something
that kind
new.
Of stuff. Yes. So I have some ink, but I do also help. Everything I've done is I've designed on my own.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Something I actually will share that Nagesh and I have known each other for a long time because through graduate school connections and whatnot, but learn something new every day. So
they're hidden.
So, well, thanks for being here. You know, I think one of the things we're hearing a lot about technology in the government lately, you've got things like PTARA going through in the NDAA, and people are talking about this. There's just between websites and as you get more call for transparency, for allowing citizens to interact with government more. Technology has become the underpinning of actually doing government. And the folks who are, you guys are the folks who are in charge of dealing with this, both inside agencies and as agencies are externally facing. And I'm not sure everybody really understands the role of what a CIO is, what a CTO is, or anybody who's handling these issues are. And, you know, CIOs have been around for in the 90s. I mean, back in 96, I think, was when they were first created. But David, what exactly is the role of a CIO? Some of this is still being figured out as things change, I know. But
right. So you're right, Jenny. Going back to the Clarence-Cohen Act of 1996, they actually said that each department and agency should have a CIO that should report to the head of the agency. And basically, the CIO is supposed to serve as that champion and actually the coordinator of the IT that's being employed across that agency or department for the purposes of making sure it's aligned to whatever the mission is. In terms of what a CIO is, that's a great question. I think the reality is there's many different types of CIOs, and the reality is you should make sure whatever CIO you get matches what that organization needs. My style of CIO is really broken into two parts, which is one, I see myself as chief digital diplomat, which is liaising across the 18 different bureaus and offices of the Federal Communications Commission and trying to make sure that the IT we are doing is actually producing public value, both for the mission of the FCC, but more and more importantly, the interfaces that we actually have with the public and with the industry. The other role that I play, and it's probably the more fun role, and it's fun in quotation marks, it's the role of a chief human flak jacket, which is because trying to introduce new technology to actually help the mission is always going to be challenging. There's going to be risk. Ideally, you buy down those risks by actually having sort of agile development methodologies. You do have good sort of stakeholder building before you actually try to do something to make sure it's actually something that people want. But I often say that in some respects, chief information officers are also chief risk officers because you run the risk of not doing anything. At the same time, you need to do something. And so it's just balancing what technology you do to actually support the mission of the office or organization that you're working with in a way that actually helps move them forward and keeps them relevant for the 21st century.
And I think risk is a good word. And I want to circle back to that later in the show because I think it's something you all probably deal with of managing risk and communicating risk. So that's certainly something. And, you know, as the CIO, you've got information broadly, and then technology is in there too, certainly a part of it. But Brian, Nagesh, you both work with technology fairly specifically. I mean, chief technologist is how you put it, Nagesh, is, you know, you're right in there and an entrepreneur in some respects.
Yeah, so my role is a little bit different, I think, from Brian, because Brian is the chief technology officer for it, in a classic sense, I believe, for HHS, and correct me if I'm wrong, whereas I'm the entrepreneur in residence. And so what I do actually is help, like David, I'm an evangelist for technology innovation development within the government. And so one of the major programs that I help oversee and advise on is the Small Business Innovation Research Grants and Small Business Technology Transfer Research Grant programs, which run across 11 federal agencies, including Health and Human Services. And so with our program, it is designed to help seed finance high-risk, high-reward technology development for the needs of the federal government, but also for commercial application. And so companies that have resulted from this granting program have included Biogen, Symantec, Qualcomm, Genentech. These are literally pivotal companies that have changed the face of technology and innovation, the way we interact with each other on a day-to-day basis. 3D printing has origins that have been seed financed by the SBIR program, dating back to early grants from NSF and some preliminary work through DARPA as well. So in my role, I'm more of an advocacy role in helping raise awareness how government can innovate and help how government can help de-risk technology innovation and development and through small business innovation and development primarily.
And I think that's a really interesting point because government is out there. I think sometimes people don't think of government as being on the forefront of technology, but it actually may be, and people don't necessarily hear about it, although they've heard all those names, Genentech, Symantec. I mean, you know all of those.
You hit it right on the head because it's funny. I was just dealing with this for the past couple of days and helping raise awareness through our media channels at SBA and also through our partnering agencies in highlighting the media aspects. So recently, there are a couple of big stories that just came out. They've 3D printed the first part on the International Space Station. Made in Space is the company that did it. What folks don't realize is that company is only a few years old, and it was seed financed by NASA's SBIR program, and very much heavily financed by that program. So, like, that was a very literal benefit that has come about, because the notion of 3D printing in space really opens the doors for next generation space travel. Because if we're going to really go and travel to Mars and go beyond the solar system, you can't take the materials and resources from the Earth over. But if you can print and build off with the resources there, that's great. Another great example is Lift Labs, which is from Health and Human Services, SBIR program from NIH. This is a spoon that helps people with tremors and Parkinson's disease.
I just read about that.
Yes.
Very cool.
Seed financed solely by NIH and acquired by Google X, and it was just in ABC News and NBC News because it's like the new device that folks who have tremors can actually eat and not shake the food as they're eating. But that was done through a seed financing from NIH's program.
And see, that's the really fun stuff. I mean, this is application for people, not just in government, but everywhere
external,
outside.
You got it.
External. And you mentioned HHS a little bit. Brian, you have, it sounds like, a little bit different role over as CTO and probably brings in everything. I mean,
sort of, yeah. Although I would say that I don't really know exactly what the classic definition of a CTO is.
Because there isn't one.
If there
out
is
there.
One, I don't think it's me. So people,
very good.
People are often surprised to hear that really what we focus on is a little bit different. So we do look at how technology can help HHS improve the delivery of our mission across the board. That's absolutely the case. And it does really, there are all kinds of different areas where that takes effect. That's everything from the bench science stuff that NIH or FDA or CDC actually does, through to policy work where, you know, we pay for a lot of state systems and things like that. But a lot of my time is actually spent focused on really trying to drive this concept of innovation throughout the department. The way we look at it is that as the world changes, as technology and as innovation, as the pace of these changes increase rapidly over the next few years, we as a government have to be able to move a little bit quicker. We have to be able to address this pace of change. We have to be much more rapidly reactive, or hopefully even proactive, when it comes to looking at how some things work and how we can incorporate those into our mission, the delivery of our mission. So we've actually created this thing at HHS called the Idea Lab, which is really focused on three major categories of efforts. Number one is investing in our internal workforce. One of the things that, this is actually interesting, one of the things that really struck me when I got to government, so when I first got to government, when I left the private sector and went to work as the CIO for Washington, D.C., everybody who knew me said I was completely nuts, right? They're like, you know, you're going to get there, there's going to be all this bureaucracy, you hate bureaucracy, red tape, craziness, right? And the first thing that I discovered, and this has held true in every job I've had, is that I've worked at every level with some of the best people I've ever worked with in my life, right? Most intelligent, most dedicated, there for the right reasons, you know, trying to really do great things. I mean, government employees, for the most part, and sure, there are exceptions to this rule, but for the most part, are phenomenal people, right? I would work with them, again, anywhere in a heartbeat. What's been interesting, though, is that all of these great people really have their hands tied by a lot of the sort of history and the culture and the red tape and the bureaucracy. And so what we're trying to do is give a lot of these people the opportunity to experiment with ideas within the framework of the federal government. We've created an internal accelerator to do this, a venture fund that we use to invest in some good ideas, some recognition programs, things like that. The second category that we focus a lot on is the idea that we have all these great people, but we also know that there's some skills and ideas that we don't have on the inside that we want to bring in. And so we've created a couple of in-residence programs where we bring people in from the outside to help us learn these skills and understand that some of these things actually are possible within the context of this government. And then the third piece is really the idea that HHS is this massive organization, right? We have 90,000 or so employees. We're organized into 11 operating divisions. These are things you've heard of, like NIH, FDA, CDC. Some you probably haven't heard of, but each one of those things operates in a massive silo, right? There are these big vertical walls. And as you drill down into the silos, you actually get more silos, right? But it turns out that if you can connect people across these vertical silos and across the vertical levels of the hierarchy, you can actually deliver on things in a much better and more effective and efficient way. And so this third category really focuses on breaking down those walls and connecting people in ways that they've never been connected before in order to execute more effectively on the mission.
And that's where technology is great on, is it really does break down barriers or flatten things out if you want. So
it does, but I think it's important to realize that the technology, and maybe this makes me a bad technologist by saying this, but the technology is just a tool, right?
Yeah. You have to have people and
behavior. Yeah. So
culture.
I can't think of, well, maybe I can think of one or two examples, but not many, where technology by itself has changed behavior.
Right.
The culture has to change. And the technology
Absolutely.
Can be an enabler or a catalyst or an accelerant to actually increasing the pace of that change. But people, at the end of the day, it's all about people. People have to want to change.
Absolutely. And I think that's a good place. We're going to stop here for our first break. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about some of those challenges that I think you all face in terms of both, you know, people, budget, culture, things like that. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around a mall and I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like Geico. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. Geico.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com, then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact Geico today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We've been talking about technology in the federal government, different programs that each of you are working on. And as we were leaving before the break, I said something about challenges and really how you do that. And one of the things that we were talking about a little bit off air is the word that Brian brought up, which are silos, and how you actually move technology, not just down, because each place has its own culture, but how do you move it across within, you know, to me, the challenge is not just within your own agency, although that's clearly a challenge you all face, but also across government as well. And so one of the questions I had, which I think we can start with here, is are agencies working together and how are you using technology to really bring people together? So
I think that's a great question, Jenny. I think agencies are working together where there are clear mission needs to deliver it to the public. But we also have to recognize that, again, that the founders actually wanted there to be checks and balances. And if you go back to the Federalist Papers, they actually intended for ambition to counter ambition. And so I think exactly as Brian said, I mean, part of the reason why I love public service is there are an amazing amount of really insightful, dedicated, caring people. Yet in some respects, the very rules and the promotion and everything that's sort of in that system is motivated much more towards having, unfortunately, those silos, because in some respects, those silos prevent the rise of a king-like individual. And the last thing that the founders wanted back in 1776 was they actually wanted the rise of another king-like individual. So the question is, in some respects, we are doing horizontal collaborations. We are using technology to work across agencies, recognizing, however, that the very checks and balances of representative democracy actually have those little fiefdoms. And so I think the way that I've sort of tried to sort of create that bubble is, can we create a safe space in which everyone can get credit for the work? Can we create the safe space in which it is okay to actually collaborate? But one example that I'll point out is there actually are rules on the books that prevent me from using my money for an effort that might also benefit Brian, because then I'm actually not using the funds for the right purposes.
Well, right. And some of that is set up maybe intentionally or unintentionally.
So, yeah, I want to address a couple of things there, right? So, first of all, I think you're right. The system is sort of set up that way. But the system was set up that way in a time where, really, before we realized that true progress doesn't happen on an individual basis, right? And it certainly doesn't happen in a group basis where everybody's focused on the same thing, right? The history of innovation, the history of disruption is really focused on this idea that it's not the guy, you know, the genius in the lab, right? Or the guy who has the eureka moment. It's the sum total of a whole set of experiences, different cultures, different backgrounds, et cetera, coming together in a place to actually come up with new ideas, right? And even the very physical layout of our buildings in the government prevents these types of collaborations from happening, right? If you walk into HHS, into the Humphrey Building, It's, you know, this concrete, massive structure, cubicles that go up to the sky. Like, the only thing that you're going to collide with is air, right? Like, you never run into people. You never have the opportunity to talk to people. So I think that, you know, while, yes, the founding fathers designed this to have a system of checks and balances, I think that we need to update the thinking a little bit for what we've learned since then in terms of how this stuff actually happens. So that's the first piece. The second thing, you know, really, I think a lot of it comes down to incentives, right? And if you think about it, there's very few incentives for people within this large bureaucracy, specifically on the career side, to really kind of try new things and to experiment with new ideas. Because if you experiment with a new idea, or really what I should say is the incentive is designed to follow process, right? If you follow a process and everything goes completely wrong at the end, you can stand back and say, hey, man, I just did what I was supposed to do.
Don't get in trouble for it. Sticking your neck
out
on it. Yeah.
But secondly, even if you do have a big win, right, or something goes remarkably well or like some great stuff happens, you don't really get much credit for it, right? So where's the incentive to actually kind of step outside that box? And so really, in a lot of ways, what we're trying to create is a completely new incentive structure, right? Where people are actually rewarded and recognized for trying new things and for experimenting. And even, you know, when things don't work, I think that's great, right? As long as we learn lessons from those things. And so we need to continue to push, I think, those ideas.
Well, and that's a really interesting point because, you know, Nagesh, I think about you saying at the beginning how you've helped all these public-private partnerships or other businesses, and you know you've each done this. I know you've been in the private sector as well. It's okay to fail in the private sector, and in fact, you almost expect that if you go out there with a big idea, you're going to fail. That's hard in government.
Well, it is, and it's funny because a lot of things they've touched about are stuff that we've been tackling over the past couple of over my past year and a couple months now into my role as chief technologist. My other title is entrepreneur in residence because I came from the startup land out in the valley, and what brought me back partially was because of a failed startup. It was the fact that I knew how to fail and saw how I failed with it, but be able to take that fearless behavior and bring it in and help encourage it. And so what was interesting about the silos is a couple of fascinating points I want to touch on. So they're correct about there being silos, and there are reasons for those silos to exist. But what's interesting is because of the internet and that means of communication and then folks facilitating that cross-collaboration and talking to you to each other in the first place, there is now a medium to engage that, reducing the barriers. And so what we've done through our process has been with the SBIR.gov centralized platform, where we have the 11 federal agencies engaging with each other through this website. But more importantly, we have, I help oversee this White House Committee on Fueling Small Business Innovation for the interagencies that are involved. But what I did was instead of just the SBIR granting agencies, I actually pulled in folks from Patent Office, National Endowment for the Arts, and other portions that may not have a direct role to SBIR, but an indirect causation to it. And so have them involved to give us insight and input, but more importantly, get the folks talking to each other. And when you talk about goal alignment, what's really interesting is you find pet projects that they can work on that they can do that they're really passionate about. And so a great example is we're starting some dialogues with the National Endowment for the Arts and trying to find ways to tie in with some of the SBIR granting agencies with the work NEA is doing and SBA is just facilitating. And one of the things is I got one of the guys on my team, SBA, he's a big art. He's very passionate about the arts, and that art science design nexus is a very important nexus to consider. So he's very much vetted into the idea of like, wait, this flows with my heart. Of course, I'm going to want to work on it. And so it comes down to figuring out and understanding the incentives, but I think the traditional thinking's always been that incentives is based on monetary, and it's not. There are three things that motivate humans to do what they do, and that's pride, love, and money. And so work with the other factors that come into play. It doesn't have to be just pride and money. I mean, yes, it's government, but love plays a huge role, and that's what makes SF so very interesting and why I live out there is because half the time the projects we engaged on was just out of pure curiosity and love for doing what we did.
And that's the people piece, the culture piece.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's where one of the things that I love to do when I parachute into a new role is I like to meet with people and say what brings them joy. Because I think a lot of people go into public service because there is a happiness or a love or a joy that comes from that service. I think partly why it's just worth trying to remember what the founders said, not saying that we obviously have to still have silos. In fact, I would actually say that all the evidence is that we actually need to actually come up with a new way, a new experiment in how we still have checks and balances. It's just recognizing that sometimes people lament and they say, well, culture change means we just need to change the types of people we have in government. It's like, well, no, actually, you have a lot of well-meaning people. But as Brian said, it's about how do we shift those incentives to actually have, in some respects, more collaborative, almost in some respects, internal market-like behavior, in which people are almost like freelancers and they're actually working across different efforts together, as opposed to being so focused on the process that they're not focusing on actually the public value they're creating.
And that's a really big challenge for the government because it is so large. It's not a small startup where it's easier to change that. And I'm going to stop here and take our mid-show break, but I'd like to pick up that thread when we come back and talk a little bit about some of those challenges. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
GEICO's famous for saving people money on car insurance. And now, if you're a federal employee, you could be saving even more. In fact, you may already qualify for a special federal discount from GEICO. If you're a federal employee, or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, FLIOA, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you could be saving hundreds of dollars. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings. GEICO got its start back in 1936, specifically to serve federal employees. Today, we're still making it easy for federal employees to save money on car insurance. If you're a federal employee, you may qualify for a special federal employee discount. Or if you belong to an association like BIG, FEW, Young Government Leaders, and many others, you may also qualify. See how much you could be saving. Contact GEICO today to get a quote and be sure to request your special federal savings.
If you're a federal manager, you deal with a lot of information. Here's a tip on breaking through the noise. Join the Federal Managers Association to have a voice on Capitol Hill. And to get filtered news and information specific to managing your workforce, join the 50,000 other federal managers who already subscribe and read the free weekly e-report, fedmanager.com. I'm Todd Wells, Executive Director of the Federal Managers Association, and I approve this message.
Welcome back. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. And we were talking a little bit about the silos and the culture, and we sort of continued our conversation off air for a minute here, but I'd like to pick some of that back up. As you know, Brian, one of the things you just said to me is that a lot of this is not a technology issue. It's a people issue. Mm-hmm. It's actually, you know, training. We mentioned budget. We've talked, you know, there's some other management issues that go into this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's I think at the end of the day, it all comes down to people, right? One of sort of key things that I believe is that the most important asset of any organization, I don't care if it's public sector, private sector, product or service organization, what have you, is the people that make it up. And if you take the time to invest in the people, then I think you will be able to accomplish whatever you want. You know, it's interesting. Let's just look at Google for a second, right? Google has their sort of famous people operations group. That's their HR department. Yep. And they do HR in a very Googly kind of way, right? They use data. They measure everything. They are very sort of transparent about the way that they do things. You know, it's all, you know, sort of, it's very thought through, right? I'm going to go out on a limb and say that one of the maybe the biggest advantage that Google has is not, you know, their products. It's not the oodles of users that they have. It's not the fact that they rake in cash every quarter. It's the fact that they have an incredibly strong workforce that they take the time and spend the resources on investing
in them.
Exactly. And they've been doing that literally since day one. And you know, like a lot of times, if you go talk to Laszlo Bock, who runs that group for Google, he'll tell you that people ask him all the time, you know, well, you know, of course Google can do this. They've got all this money, they can spend it all, they can do whatever they want to do. His response is, look, you know, back in the days when Google was starting, we always did things like this when we had zero money, right? And it's just, it's like little things that change the game. And so I really believe that we have an incredibly strong workforce here in the federal government. If we invested that in that workforce in a way that was a little bit different than what we have done in the past, which is to say, really, you know, not that much. I mean, we have these online trainings and we do, you know, things like that. We could actually really change the game.
And part of it is having that thought and having it enterprise wide of mm-hmm. what sort of, how do you invest in people? And that's, I mean, I sing from the same hymn book there on that, is that you have to invest in people and yep. nobody does it in the concrete way. And part of that is, you know, agencies, unlike private sector, are constrained by budgets from Congress, some of the laws that they pass that do things, but you can get by.
But hang on. I mean, let's be honest. The private sector organizations are constrained by budget, too.
Right,
and in
absolutely.
Fact, they're more constrained by budget in a lot of cases yeah. than the public sector. Okay. So, like, I think we should take that off the table as an excuse.
Yeah.
I mean, we could make a decision to do things in a different way, and I think we should.
And that comes down to people wanting to do it. And, you know, you guys, I feel like, have a little bit of flexibility to do some of that.
It's people, and it's crafting the narrative and explaining the narrative forward. So we were talking about this offline a little bit, but crafting the story. I think when anyone thinks about government, the first word that comes to mind is bureaucracy. Oh, red tape. Oh, just folks pushing buttons and saying yes or no. And part of this, what's interesting, what HHS pioneered, and so did SBA and a few other agencies, and along with the FCC, is say, well, let's have these entrepreneur resident programs and bring the cool kids and make them understand what's cool about coming into government. I love the fact that there was that article, was it a few months ago, with Washington Post did on Mikey Dickerson from GSA, and just telling folks who are in that creative world space, like, hey, why don't you spend some time in government and make it part of your civic duty to help facilitate better governance? You know, don't just go for it.
I want to push back on that a little.
Okay,
bit.
Go for it.
So we have a program called Entrepreneurs in Residence to bring people in from the outside world to work on, you know, what we consider to be sort of complex but high reward projects that we don't have the skills to work on the inside. We do this for two reasons. One of the reasons is clearly to solve some problems, right? We want to actually work on delivering on these somewhat complex and challenging issues. But the real reason we do it is to teach people on the inside that there are different ways of doing things and that there are different things that they can do to actually move forward. I think personally, we have a little bit of a problem right now with a bit of a Silicon Valley fetish going on in the government. And, you know, while there are, and look, I lived in San Francisco for 8 years, right? Started a company there, you know, did all this stuff. While there are great people in San Francisco and in the Bay Area, there are great people in government too. And, you know, I don't think we should be looking to this outside group as sort of the saviors of everything that, you know, we've been able, you know, we've done wrong for years. I actually think that if we empowered people that are currently part of the government to step up, give them the freedom, give them the responsibility, and hold them accountable for delivery, they would blow you away, right? Blow you away. And they're career feds, right?
I won't disagree with you with that, because I, as a former career fed one time at the patent office, you're absolutely right on that perspective. But what I think what's interesting is that you're correct on the Silicon Valley fetish. And I won't disagree with you on that. In fact, I also get annoyed with it too. But what I will say is that it's not the Silicon Valley fetish. It's the getting the folks from the outside coming in. So it doesn't have to be from Silicon Valley. It can come from the Midwest. It can come from Texas. It can come from Chicago. It's getting folks from outside of DC to come in and spend some time and help share best practices, because every system is a little bit different. But more importantly, you're right about the empowering the government folks who are the career feds to want to take ownership. You're absolutely right on that. But I think what'd be interesting is that you want to get, it's transition time. You have to have people move around and whatnot. It leads for better government.
It's definitely a good idea to get new people, new ideas, new everything flowing through the system, right? I mean,
right.
This is the whole idea behind disruptive innovation. So totally agree with that. But the problem I have is the way it's positioned is that these people coming in are the ones that have all the ideas. And
right.
That are, you know, they're the ones who know how to do things the right way and et cetera. And look, they know how to do things a different way. And that different way is absolutely important, right? But there's a intersection between the new and different way and the, you know, other new and different way that comes from the internal perspective that I think needs to be taken into account.
And if I could build on that, actually, in a past life, I was with the MIT Center for Collective Intelligence. And actually what that shows is you actually get a much better outcome when you have a huge diversity of participants. If you have any one group of experts, whether they be from the outside or the inside, they'll actually subperform that diversity. And I think that's one of the things that often when I try to like motivate teams, I say it's an opportunity for positive impact, an OPI, a reverse IPO. How can we actually bring together all these different perspectives to have a better outcome? And I think that's where it's all about leadership. And really that leaders should actually be, how can you manage the initial friction when a new team meets an existing team so they can eventually become one team, one mission?
Well, and you have to have some of this is just having change. I mean, whether it's inside, outside, giving people the ability
change
to
agents.
Change.
I mean, change agents. In fact, some respects, that I think that's one thing that we'll all three agree on is we need more change agents in public service.
Or people who feel empowered to be change agents. Because I spend a lot of time defending the civil service broadly, to the media, to Congress, to whomever. And one of the things is that I think there are people in the government who are, and you all are in government. I mean, we're sitting here talking to three people, whether your political career or otherwise, is empowering people to do that. And one thing that I've heard Director Archuleta say, who's OPM's director, she met with, I think it was Laszlo, she was over at Google, I guess, a while ago, and she tells this story where, you know, he said, despite everything we do to invest in our people, the one thing we cannot compete with the federal government is the dream of public services mission.
Yeah.
And,
yeah,
you know, people come in and out. And so it's how do you capitalize on mission and then take it the step further?
So here's what we do, right? and every time that that I've tried to implement some kind of new, you know, thing that requires behavior change, we've always kind of taken the same approach, which is that when you look at the way people change, they exist on sort of this bell curve of adoption, right? Where on the left-hand side, you've got the laggards, right? The middle left, you've got the late adopters, late followers and the early followers, and then the early adopters all the way on the right. The laggards will never change, right? Or it will take forever. It will take a lot of time and effort. There's not a lot of point in investing in that group of people initially because it won't go anywhere, right? So we always focus on the early adopters. We always focus on the right-hand side of that curve because they're the people who are like ready to go. You give them, you know, a hint of possibility and they're like, yeah, we're there. And from there, what we've seen happen, and this has happened across HHS now in a pretty interesting way, you generate some initial successes with those folks. They, they become your champions. And then the ideas progress down that curve and you start getting people who you never would have thought would be interested in what you're working on to stand up and say, you know what, I've got this idea too. I want to do this because I think I can actually get it done now. And we're starting to see this progression down the curve. So it's really, really interesting.
But it takes a while. That's part of it is what you guys do inherently with technology changes quickly in terms of the mechanisms and processes, but culture change and somehow agencies work is slower.
So I'm going to quote David here. who was quoting a Harvard professor in an email that he sent out yesterday that basically said something like, it used to be the case that the political folks would come in and create these grand long-term visions and that the career folks would be responsible for managing the day-to-day of actually achieving those grand long-term visions. And now it's sort of flipped to this thing where the politicals come in and they have these short-term wins that they're focused on. Yep. And the career folks are left with holding the bag of like creating this long-term vision. And I think that is right on. I mean, it's totally true. It's very, very hard for us to kind of think about the grand long term anymore. And I don't know if that's because of the 24/7 news cycle. I don't know if that's because, you know, we've as a culture become accustomed to, you know, sort of immediate gratification.
Right. Everything
type stuff.
Has to be right now, 140 yeah. characters.
Yeah.
Let's go.
But you know, to change our system and to change society and to change the world, that doesn't happen overnight. You know, you have
Absolutely.
To be willing to be in it for the long game.
Yeah. And I think that's, you know, that's one of the biggest challenges is some of these things are really long term that you guys are dealing with. I mean, in terms of changing culture, getting buy-in, getting people trained and hired. Well, and
the program that I help oversee has been around for over 30 years. I mean, the seed investing we did in 3D printing dates back to 94. And so part of that narrative when I came on was to explain that when these grants go down, people are like, oh, what's the return on investment? What's the return on investment? I said, well, what's the net present value? What's the long term? Because people are like, well, show me what it's done. I said, well, trace back to 3D printing, but that happened in 94, but you had to wait. You had to wait for a lot of things to mature in order for that to come about. But that is an industry of its own right that is, gotten everyone ginned up because it really has great potential. And so it's elucidating on that and making it clear so people really get comfortable and used to it. And part of it is just having intellectual debates and intellectually challenging the leadership. So one of the things that's really great is my bosses, Javier Sade and Praveen Aragaman, allow me to challenge and intellectually challenge. And we encourage our team to challenge. If something does not make sense, go ahead and challenge it and say why. Put everything on the table, and then we figure out, you know, where to go from there. And, you know, Brian, you brought something interesting up that I think we were talking offline, but it's the mechanism. And so details, I think, in federal government are great. They're actually a great learning opportunity, because I had a detailee come from HHS, and I have one right now from the patent office. And what's great is those folks come in, they get some good learning experience, different ways of thinking. And then if they decide to go back, which, you know, hopefully they do, they go back feeling empowered to take that information and implement it into their work and also help cross-pollinate a bit better. And I think what would help with better governance is folks moving on. I mean, I was at Commerce for a bit, then I left and did startups for a while, and then I came back and joined SBA. Yeah. And I left from a different role, practicing patent law, to doing and practicing startups and being an entrepreneur for a bit.
Well, part of it's
design engineer.
It's sharing some of those stories and sharing the experiences, because if you don't hear about what you all are doing, and I think you all hear about it across the, you know, CIO, CTO realm, but do your rank and file folks know what's going on? And that's a challenge. And we're going to stop here and take our final break of the show. You're listening to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
Today, my journey to help save people money on car insurance brought me to our nation's capital. I was taking a stroll around the mall when I met a very nice gentleman from Ohio who asked me a question. What kind of word is GEICO anyway? An excellent question, I replied. I told him that GEICO isn't a word, it's an acronym, and it stands for Government Employees Insurance Company. I explained how GEICO actually got its start 75 years ago to help federal employees save money on car insurance. Interesting, the man replied. But today, GEICO saves lots of people money on car insurance, including me. Have you ever thought about changing the name? I said. It's a thought. But Gecko sounds like GEICO. If we change the name, I might be out of a job. We strolled a bit more, stopped for some tea, and we both agreed. It's probably best to keep the name just like it is. GEICO.
To get a free rate quote, go to geico.com. Then buy online or over the phone. If you're a federal employee or belong to an association like Big, Few, Young Government Leaders, and others, you may qualify for a special discount. Contact GEICO today to request your special federal savings.
Welcome back to Fed Talk on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. We're entering the last segment of our show, and we've been having a good conversation about culture, people, getting the word out, all of that. And one of the things I just said to you all as we took our break was the hardest challenge I find is not just telling people who are maybe in the CIO world or in the CTO world, but how do you communicate this to everybody else? How do you get out there? Because I don't think if I'm off doing something that's so not what I would consider in my brain technologically integrated there, how do I see that this works for me? Is that training? Is it just talking to people and sharing stories? How do you get down there?
Federal News Radio 1500.
Right, right here on this show. This is getting the word out.
The power of the narrative is really key. Is it's finding opportunities for that narrative to get out. But there's also the interesting paradox, which is if you're really busy doing great stuff, you may not have the time to do that. And so it's, in some respects, it's almost like an additional duty is assigned outside of your normal job, outside of your normal hours. But I think all of us, and that's partly why we're here, and partly why we're also on social media, that's also why we try to attend conferences and make that effort, is it's not that we don't have a lack of things to do. In fact, we probably have too many things to do. It's just that if you don't take the time to start share that message and do that cross-pollination, again, trying to work horizontal, even if the system inherently was not designed to be that way, we can change that design through our actions and be change agents. We have to get that communication out. But I think the other thing is make sure when you share that story, sort of getting to what Nagesh was saying, people are motivated when they have a sense of autonomy and freedom. Can you give them that? The research also shows that people are motivated when there's a sense of measurable progress. Can you give them that? And the good thing that we do have in spades in public service, the other thing that motivates people is a compelling mission. So we got that one. We just need to make sure we're also giving autonomy and we're also giving measurable progress on what we're doing.
I think one thing I wanted to point out, underutilized talent, interns. Interns are great. I have a flock of interns who work for me religiously, and they're great. and they're smart, and I empower them with projects. I don't make them go get coffee. I actually give them real projects and say,
the newer version of interns, not
But so, for example, I had David participate in an event we did with the Italian Embassy. It was a US-EU enabling transatlantic collaboration on around research and development. And I actually, the birth of that endeavor, and it's now going to hopefully become a series of symposiums that go down, was through my interns. I actually challenged them, and they were students from Georgetown and American University. I said, give me something that you think makes sense. And they just, you know, mulled around for a while, and then they met this really interesting guy from the Italian Embassy who's a scientific attaché, and over noodling and time, we birthed the symposium and started this conversation with the European Union Science and Technology Research Council, which is really cool.
It was an extremely impressive event.
Yes. It was a full house, I think, right?
Yeah. Standing remotely, actually.
Yeah. So the whole idea is using talent in the right way and enabling them and encouraging them to learn and then grow and build off on it. And so I always make it a very clear point with my interns is like, go do it, go attend the conferences. I don't need to be there. Go do it. And you know, I actually challenged them. I said, go find us an event that you can speak at. Go ahead. And I'll train you. I'll help you learn and understand so that you're not uncomfortable or making sure you're telling the talk points right. Because at the end of the day, we have to make sure you're representing, you know, your or office properly, but I empower them to learn early on.
And that's where I think, I mean, both what I'm hearing with what Brian does and what Nagesh does, and I think it's so inspiring, is they are creating these sort of almost incubator spaces for their individuals that they can actually sort of help them actually be free agents, and they're actually creating that new model. So that even if we have to be the flak jackets because the model is not necessarily applied to us, I think what a good CIO, CTO, or entrepreneur in residence can do is make sure, at least for those people that you can, create that incubator space where they can actually help make change happen.
It's almost the, you know, to use the HR word, it's almost a train the trainer sort of thing. Yeah. You go out there, you train the next person. But, you know, as much as I think what you guys are doing is really innovative, you do hit the barriers of, you know, you get somebody who doesn't believe in what you do, or they hear technology. They just hear the word regardless of what you're doing, and they say, I don't know technology.
We're constantly
I don't do that.
Banging our heads against the wall. You just have to smile and keep on pressing on.
Right.
But that also gets about to getting the word out is we all have to recharge our batteries eventually. And so that's where I'm a big believer in the network effect. Is not only is the network effect actually how you make change happen, but in some respects, when you're banging your head against the wall, it's nice to know you're not the only one. Mm-hmm. And in some respects, you can actually sort of bring each other up as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, the phrase I like to use for a lot of this is risk aggregator, right? Because in a lot of ways, that's my job, right? My job is to basically help people who feel like they can't assume the risk,
right?
See what happens.
Yep, you can. And then I think that's really leadership, is that we often don't distinguish between leadership and management. And I always like to quote that leadership comes from the Greek word leet, which means to send unto death. And so what we're doing is we're sort of buying that risk that if this doesn't work out, we'll take that painful hit. Hopefully we won't die, but we'll take it. So that way the individual can actually be free to be brave enough to actually see if whatever they're trying to do, the change effort, will actually work.
Well, and that's where I think risk management, you know, I mentioned this at the beginning of the show, risk is a big word in, you know, both the positive and the negatives, because you have to assume the risk to go out there, both in processes, in the technology, but also in the people piece, communicate the risk and explain it to people of why it's okay to take the risk, or when there are bad risks, what that means.
Ask for more data. I mean, I think the thing that you always ask is, if you look at something and someone's trying to make a case as to whether or not this risk is something we should pursue, if you think that there's not sufficient data, or if you ask what are the possible three things that could go wrong and what's your mitigation strategy, and they don't have an answer, then it's like, we'll come back and actually sort of play out what would be the three possible things that could go wrong and have that mitigation strategy. And then, like all things we have to do, the same thing in the private sector. You roll the dice. Hopefully you've got a good team in place. Hopefully you have a plan and you can adapt it as necessary, and you see what happens.
And as we have a few minutes left, I want to ask about that. You know, you mentioned data, and, you know, again, as much as a lot of this is people and culture, you still have the actual hardware technology. You still have some of those things you have to deal with, of collecting the right data, having the actual tools to do that. And I get the sense sometimes that that is a challenge in the government world, is that a lot of our regulations are from pre-internet, pre-real technology time. A lot of the actual hardware itself is from, you know, 20 years ago. And so you're trying to do all, be change agents with a somewhat outdated actual mechanism there. Is that a correct assessment of some of the challenges that you face?
I mean, in some respects, it's like the Peace Corps model, which is turn over a trash can, use that as your chair, and get to work.
Yeah.
You know, we just have to work whatever we can in the field. I'm hopeful because in some respects, while a lot of people are talking about moving to the cloud, and there's a lot of much more that goes with that, that will actually get us out of the hardware business. And in some respects, it will also ideally get us out of the software business so we can actually focus much more on the change itself. But you're right, that the law will never keep up with technology. And so that's always an issue of how can we make sure we make the best of the situation we've got. And it's going to require creative thinking. In some respects, the thing that I love about this public service role is each day you're challenged and each day you have to be creative.
You guys get to be a little bit like MacGyver with duct tape and
yeah,
in the
but,
field.
So I'd like to push on one thing, that regulation, as much as it's known as a boogie word, sometimes it's not a bad thing. I mean, it's all about perspectiveness on it all. Regulation sometimes is there because, as we've been talking about, people are just not ready.
Right.
And if people are not ready, it's there to kind of protect the welfare of society until we have it implemented in the appropriate manner.
Yeah. Right. I mean, there are different kinds of regulations, right? I mean, you know, Food and Drug Administration, just as an example, has a pretty clear remit that, and within the context of that remit, has an important mission, which is to ensure the analytic and clinical validity of claims that people and companies make. Otherwise, you'd have the snake oil salesman out there all the time,
right?
And when you're talking about public health, it's a big deal. At the same time, you know, just something that I was talking about a little bit earlier, there's this one set of regulations, just as an example, that basically were written in 1992. They dictate how we pay for a certain type of system, money that we send to the states. And while the regulation was written with very good intentions in 1992, the things that it describes make zero sense in today's technology world. But so the sort of unintended consequences of that are that you have four or five big vendors, the ones that we all know, that basically provide this technology to the states, and there's zero incentive for any new player to come in and break into that. So, you know, and then the other problem is that the process of changing the regulations takes so long that, you know, even when you get it out, you're still behind if you've kind of thought about it from a technology perspective. So what we're trying to do is look at the way that we create those kinds of regulations in almost a technology neutral way, right? The technology is going to change. The technology is not necessarily the important part. What's important is the motivations behind the choices, right? And the outcomes that we're trying to achieve, as opposed to the mechanics of it.
And that's a great place to stop. We're getting to the end, but I think that's going forward where this conversation is going to have to be, is how do you create it looking forward? Because we'll never know 50 years from now what we're going to be looking at, and how do you get up there? Well, I want to thank each of you for being on the show today. I could think we could talk about this for hours and go into other things.
Thanks for having us, Jen.
So awesome.
It's been a pleasure, and we'll definitely bring you guys back, and hope you all have a good weekend. Thanks for joining us. Fed Talk is brought to you by the Federal Employment Law Firm of Shaw, Bransford, and Roth. Have a great weekend.